Welcome to EIR Talks. This week we present the LaRouche Connection, an audio-video news magazine produced by Executive Intelligence Review, which was founded in 1974 by Lyndon H. LaRouche.
It's now 2 p.m., Thursday, September 13th, 2001, slightly more than 48 hours after the simultaneous attacks against the World Trade Center towers in New York City and against the Pentagon right outside of the nation's capital in Washington, D.C. There are many things at this point that are not known about these horrific actions, and there are certain things that we do know, which we will be discussing over the course of the next moments. So it's more appropriate at this moment to consider what we're going through by way of a key background briefing, so that the proper parameters for understanding the events that have already occurred and the events that are likely to occur over the immediate days and weeks and ahead can be properly evaluated and hopefully proper corrective actions taken. Now, we had the extraordinary good fortune in a moment of great national and international tragedy to have had Lyndon LaRouche Jr., a pre-candidate for the 2004 Democratic Party presidential nomination and the founding and contributing editor of Executive Intelligence Review, appearing live on a radio interview show in Salt Lake City, Utah, precisely at the moment that the first word was coming in of the strikes against the Pentagon and against the World Trade Center. And so Mr. LaRouche had the opportunity to provide a running dialogue, commentary, and early assessment of those horrible developments and some initial ideas on the kind of policy direction that the United States must take to deal with this act of strategic irregular warfare. Let me repeat that term once again, strategic irregular warfare. The actions against the World Trade Center and against the Pentagon should not be defined as acts of terrorism. It would be demeaning, and it would be a gross underestimation of the character of the attacks that were carried out just slightly more than 48 hours ago. My name is Jeff Steinberg. I'm a senior editor with Executive Intelligence Review, and I'll be taking you through this background briefing over the course of the next 20 to 30 minutes. Now, Mr. LaRouche used the term strategic covert operation to characterize what occurred in New York and Washington, D.C. 2 days ago. Why did he choose those terms? First of all, if you dissect the events themselves, regardless of any information having yet come to light as to the nature of the networks that were involved in the operation, certain things should be immediately very clear. It is our estimate and the considered estimation of a number of security experts, both in and out of government, with whom we've spoken over the last 48 hours, that the operation that was conducted on September 11th required the active participation of at minimum 25 to 30 hijackers and perhaps as many as 100 additional people involved in various aspects of support in preparation for the attack. So already we are talking about a formidable force, one that would constitute a special operations team of not insignificant size, operating in at least three different locations on the eastern seaboard of the United States. Four planes were hijacked simultaneously by teams of anywhere from 5 to 8 people per plane. The takeovers themselves, by and large, were carried out with a great deal of efficiency. And in each of those instances, a member of the team of covert operatives was a trained, skilled pilot who was able to basically take over the controls of the plane midair, basically disassemble the existing flight pattern automatic pilot systems, turn off the transponders, change route, and then, by way of various direct or circuitous paths, hit head-on with deadly accuracy, two of the towers in the World Trade Center, and then several minutes later, crash into one of the wings of the Pentagon just outside of Washington, D.C. These were not garden variety operations that could have been conducted by amateurs. Contrary to what some commentators have already said about computer flight simulators being sufficient to allow this operation to be carried out, this is a gross misestimation. The fact of the matter is that these teams were well versed in the entire security structures of the Federal Aviation Administration and NORAD systems operating in North America. They knew perfectly well the kinds of techniques that would be required to avoid being intercepted and prevented from reaching their deadly targets. They specifically chose planes, commercial aircraft, that were scheduled to make transcontinental flights, knowing that those planes alone would be sufficiently full of fuel so that the attacks against these targeted buildings would have their maximum amount of lethal effect. In fact, the two World Trade Center towers that both collapsed as the result of the enormously high heat, estimated temperatures between 1 and 2,000 degrees Fahrenheit, as the result of the massive amounts of fuel that were burning once those buildings were struck with these aircraft. Now, bear in mind that this operation had to have been in the planning and staging phases for a period of at least 6 months prior to execution. So we're talking about teams of irregular warfare specialists on the ground in the United States preparing an operation during a period when the United States was presumably on a heightened security alert. There was a heightened alert around the Washington, D.C. area in anticipation of the upcoming, now presumably canceled, meeting of the IMF and World Bank, meetings that were scheduled to be major targets of terrorist attack, far more deadly attack than we even saw in July of this year in Genoa, Italy, at the Group of Eight summit meeting. New York City was under a similar security alert status because virtually every head of state in the world was scheduled to be coming in and out of New York City during this month due to the opening session of the United Nations General Assembly. We know that at least 3 weeks in advance of the attack on Tuesday, September 11th, U.S. government agencies, including the CIA and the State Department, had put out alert warnings around the globe. There was an anticipated high-level attack targeted against U.S. officials, U.S. installations around the world. We know that the U.S. Embassy in Tokyo was one of the targets that was particularly considered ripe for such an attack. 3 weeks before the attack was mounted, the Chief National Security Advisor of the President of Egypt, Osama al-Baz, came to Washington to meet with high-ranking officials of the Bush administration to alert them to details about pending attacks. There was concern about a destabilization of Egypt, perhaps an overthrow of the Egyptian government by radical factions in the context of the ongoing Israeli operations, genocidal operations, against the Palestinian Authority, the policy of targeted extermination of the leadership of the Palestinian Authority to eliminate a peace partner for the Sharon government inside Israel. And there are elements inside the Israeli Defense Force and inside the Israeli government who are far more dangerous and insane than even Ariel Sharon. Several weeks ago on the LaRouche Connection, we warned about the danger of even an inside assassination of Ariel Sharon by even more extreme elements, perhaps wishing to provoke a new world war emanating out of the Middle East. Now, it's important to realize that at the same time that we are focusing on these actions, these strategic covert operations carried out against the United States, a major provocation destabilization, that we are also facing an imminent blowout of the world financial system. Even prior to the events of Tuesday, September 11th, there were frequent warnings of a major collapse, even beyond what we've seen in the recent months, of the international financial and monetary system. As this show goes to press, we are awaiting the prospects of news of a major derivatives failure, perhaps on a scale substantially larger than the September 1998 collapse of the LTCM hedge fund that almost brought down the entire global financial and monetary system. So we are in extraordinary times in which business as usual is not on the table. The United States has already been hit, as has the rest of the world, with precisely the Pearl Harbor effect that Lyndon LaRouche has been speaking of for many years, the kind of shock that will hopefully wake up the American people from the slumber of virtual reality, media brainwashing, and denial about the nature of the global financial meltdown and the actual crisis of institutions in the United States that has now been demonstrated. Now, one of the very first things that Lyndon LaRouche said during his live interview as the events were unfolding, his radio interview in Salt Lake City on the Jack Stockwell show, was that immediately after learning of these events in New York and then later at the Pentagon, he warned against people jumping to the conclusion that this was an act of, quote, terrorism carried out by Osama bin Laden. And sure enough, in the 48-hour period since the attack, virtually all of the major national and international media has tunnel-visioned their attention on the idea that this was an attack launched by Osama bin Laden, perhaps with the backing of so-called rogue states like Iraq or Iran. What LaRouche said as the events were first unfolding was, forget it. This is not Osama bin Laden. No one operating out of some remote cave in the middle of Afghanistan possessed the resources or the international capability of conducting such an act of covert strategic special operations, which is what happened in New York and Washington 2 days ago. Now, LaRouche also emphasized that far beyond Osama bin Laden, we do know of a vast new international terrorist capability, a terrorist capability that LaRouche himself identified in great detail in the pages of Executive Intelligence Review in a series of special dossiers published in October and November of 1995. LaRouche talked about the Afghanzi Mujahideen, that were not some rogue Islamic terrorist operation created by the likes of Osama bin Laden. The Afghanzi Mujahideen were created beginning in 1979 and running throughout the decade of the 1980s by U.S., British, and Israeli intelligence services as part of what we knew at the time as the secret parallel government. We know about the Iran-Contra affair, and we know that during the same time frame, a far more ghastly operation was put in place by these Western intelligence services to create an army of Mujahideen fighters to drive the Soviet Red Army out of Afghanistan. And of course, in 1989, indeed, the Soviet Red Army did leave Afghanistan, leaving behind a vast Afghanzi structure, a structure trained and created by U.S., British, and Israeli intelligence services that had been trained to carry out acts of warfare, irregular warfare, conventional warfare. They had been trained in organized criminal activity. Afghanistan and Pakistan, during the period of that Afghanistan war, became the largest source of opium and heroin production in the entire world. So we, in effect, created the largest narco-terrorist infrastructure ever established in history. And once the Soviet Red Army pulled out of Afghanistan, we left that Afghanzi Mujahideen apparatus intact, high and dry, to simply return to their host countries and do the only thing they knew how to do, which was to conduct irregular warfare, organized crime activity, drug trafficking, etc. So we inflicted upon the world, by we, I mean specifically to say George Bush Sr., Margaret Thatcher, elements of Israeli intelligence, who were in charge of the relevant security structures of the United States, Britain, and Israel at the time that these operations were launched, conducted, and then were ultimately left on the open market to carry out their deadly business. There are many unanswered questions that are now provoked by the actions in New York City and Washington, including the question of what rogue elements in the intelligence communities of the United States, Britain, and Israel may have been still involved on a continuous basis with these Afghanzi irregular warfare forces. Now, in 1995, in the opening article of the EIR special dossier, Lyndon LaRouche had specifically warned that unless this capability was dismantled by concerted and cooperative action by the U.S. government and by allied governments around the world, this scourge would inflict damages far beyond anything imaginable, that the new international terrorism, what LaRouche has more recently called strategic covert warfare, represent a capability beyond anything that had been assembled in the 1970s or the 1980s. And so the terrorism, the irregular warfare that we face from this apparatus represents something that needs to be erased from the face of the earth. And that means, first and foremost, owning up to the fact that George Bush Sr., Margaret Thatcher, many circles inside Israel, were wittingly involved in unleashing this apparatus on the world. Now, in his interview with Jack Stockwell on the morning of September 11th, even as the events were unfolding, Lyndon LaRouche had certain critical advice to present to President Bush, advice that one would hope would be taken up by President Bush, because this is the only way that he has a chance of salvaging his presidency and saving the United States from destruction. What LaRouche said is that the president must demonstrate a degree of calm, confident assurance. LaRouche cited the very first statements that Franklin Delano Roosevelt uttered when he came in as president of the United States amidst the buildup towards World War and a global depression in March of 1933, when Roosevelt said, "We have nothing to fear so much as fear itself." LaRouche proposed that President Bush put together a group of informal advisors with the best of experience on this area of this kind of strategic irregular warfare. And of course, nobody is more qualified to participate in such an informal advisory group than Lyndon LaRouche himself. He said next that President Bush had to contact Russian President Vladimir Putin, because in combination, the United States and Russia, as the two last remaining superpowers on this planet, represent the combined capabilities working in cooperation to tackle and dismantle this irregular warfare capability. And of course, LaRouche said that once having contacted President Putin, the two men should then contact the leaders of Western Europe, of Japan, of China, and of other key countries around the globe to put together a concerted operation to take out this entire irregular warfare capability. Now, there's a few other things to bear in mind so that no potential source of this irregular warfare nightmare is left off of the table and perhaps left intact. Recall that in May of this year, evidence surfaced that the Federal Bureau of Investigation had withheld crucial documents from the defense team of Timothy McVeigh, one of the convicted Oklahoma City bombers. And at the time, despite the egregious misconduct by the FBI and the Justice Department, Attorney General John Ashcroft, one of the more unreliable and unsavory characters in this present Bush administration, demanded that the execution of Timothy McVeigh go forward regardless of that government misconduct. On May 25th, Lyndon LaRouche issued a warning statement saying that apart from the issue of the death penalty, and LaRouche is a fervent opponent of the death penalty on virtually any circumstances, but apart from that issue, LaRouche argued that the execution, the pay-per-view snuff film execution of Timothy McVeigh would represent a grave national security threat to the United States. Why? Because Timothy McVeigh represents one of the few known people on this planet who had intimate knowledge about the broader networks responsible for the Oklahoma City bombing, far more so than his co-conspirator, Terry Nichols. EIR reported at the time of the Oklahoma City bombing, within days and then within weeks afterwards, that the best military expertise that was directly involved in the investigation of Oklahoma City had reached the conclusion that Timothy McVeigh and Terry Nichols could not have possibly carried out such a deadly, sophisticated terrorist attack on their own, that there were far more sophisticated networks, domestic or international or both, that were involved in that incident, and that the government had made a calculated decision to cover up that broader conspiracy by convicting McVeigh and Nichols as lone terrorist assassins. So, with the execution of Timothy McVeigh on June 11th, 2001, one of the few people who may have given further light to the networks behind that atrocity, an atrocity, I should say, that represented a relatively small-scale act of violence compared to what we saw on September 11th, we eliminated a potentially crucial witness to the Oklahoma City operation. And we don't know at this moment, therefore, whether or not leads that might have been provided by Timothy McVeigh might have prevented or enabled the preempting of the actions of September 11th. Since we are eliminating the idea that this was an Osama bin Laden alone operation, one cannot rule out the possibility that there was a domestic component to this operation. There were indications and leads emanating from the McVeigh investigation in Oklahoma City suggesting possible connections into groups like Abu Sayyaf, one of the leading organizations spawned out of the Afghanzi Mujahideen operation of U.S., British, and Israeli intelligence sponsorship. There were indications of Terry Nichols having traveled to the area in Mindanao where Abu Sayyaf was carrying out training from, quote, former U.S. military personnel. So the execution of McVeigh at the insistence of Attorney General John Ashcroft represented an egregious error that may have very well contributed to the events of 48 hours ago. That's an open-ended question that we at this point are not in a position to answer. There are, of course, many other questions that we are not in a position to answer at this point. However, the fact remains that there must be a coordinated and concerted effort to force leading governments around the world to work in a cooperative fashion to get to the bottom of these irregular warfare attacks and to make sure that accurate intelligence is developed to determine who were the actual perpetrators. We cannot have a replay of the cover-up that took place around the Oklahoma City bombing, where viable leads were simply buried for the sake of expediency, of convicting one man as a lone assassin in order to make government law enforcement agencies look good and to give false reassurances to the American people so that they could go back into their media-driven virtual reality of denial. Now, we are facing a situation today in which the President of the United States is going to be confronted simultaneously with two of the gravest crises to face any American president, perhaps since the time of Franklin Roosevelt. Maybe there were moments during the Kennedy presidency where a similar scale of world-shaping decisions were on the plate of the President of the United States. As LaRouche emphasized in his interview with Jack Stockwell 2 days ago, we know that George Bush was placed in the White House at the initiative of the financial establishment in this country and abroad that was anxious to assure that a pliable dummy was installed as President of the United States because it was a foregone conclusion by these financial oligarchical networks that we would be confronted with a global financial meltdown crisis during the presidency that would run from 2001 to 2005. And so the campaign of LaRouche was systematically suppressed by corrupt elements in the Democratic Party and in the media. The Supreme Court of Scalia rubber-stamped the exclusion of LaRouche, thereby tearing up the Voting Rights Act of 1965. As the result, the American people were given a choice between two corrupt dummies, George W. Bush and Albert Gore. And we got exactly that. So we're faced with the financial meltdown of the century and the irregular warfare attack of the century. And the president is faced with responding to those two simultaneous crises and has little experience and little capacity to actually carry those extraordinary responsibilities out properly. Nevertheless, he's the president of the United States. Nevertheless, he is going to be put in the position of having to make those decisions. Therefore, there has to be an FDR factor in the environment around the presidency that dominates the decision-making process.
You're listening to EIR Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. Welcome back to EIR Talks. We'll continue now with the LaRouche Connection, produced by Executive Intelligence Review.
And here's where the issue of the candidacy of Lyndon LaRouche, the role of LaRouche as someone who has not only been forecasting and warning about these irregular warfare attacks and about the financial global meltdown crisis, but he's also been the leading figure on this planet who has provided appropriate solutions to those crises. Recall that LaRouche has been the architect of the call for a new Bretton Woods conference, which is the only approach that will actually work to deal with the meltdown crisis of the entire global financial and monetary system, a crisis that as of this year has already reached the phase of infecting the real productive economies of the world, so that unlike 1997 and 98, when we had the first big shocks of this global meltdown process, today we're confronted with a collapse of the physical economies of the United States, Western Europe, and Japan simultaneously. There is no solution alternative to LaRouche's New Bretton Woods. And the term LaRouche's New Bretton Woods is essential to understand the steps that have to be taken, because there are fakers and charlatans who represent the interests of the very financial institutions that created this crisis, who may wish to hijack the Bretton Woods concept and keep LaRouche and LaRouche's specific policy proposals out of the equation. We've already seen one such initiative on the part of former chairman of Lazard Frères Bank, Felix Roatan, to call for his own brand of a Bretton Woods conference, radically different than that being proposed by LaRouche. And LaRouche has responded directly to the fakery and challenge represented by this effort by Roatan, former Fed Chairman Paul Volcker, and others. So what we have at this moment is a crisis in progress, unfolding in Washington, in capitals around the world, in every financial center on this planet. And we hope that the information that we have provided to you as this crisis is still unraveling will give you some framework for understanding both the stakes and the necessary solutions to make sure that under these circumstances, every step is taken to ensure that President Bush and those around him do the right thing. If that fails to occur, if the president is induced into a flight forward in which he carries out a military operation against the wrong targets, then there is a very real chance that this country and the world as a whole will not survive as we know them, and this planet will be plunged into a dark age that will take many several generations to come out of. For the LaRouche Connection, this is Jeff Steinberg. On Saturday, September 1st, 2001, Lyndon LaRouche addressed an audience of more than 1,000 people at the annual Labor Day weekend conference of the Schiller Institute and International Caucus of Labor Committees in Northern Virginia. Last week, the LaRouche Connection presented the first hour of Mr. LaRouche's address, and we will now present the concluding 20 minutes of that speech.
Isn't it the most wonderful thing in the world, from a standpoint of understanding history, to re-experience in your own mind the actual act of discovery of a great principle made by a great thinker from the past? Suddenly, that person is alive. They never died. Because an actual moment of creative thought, which they had, you have replicated in your own mind. They live inside you. When you act, if you act well, you change the outcome of their lives. When you take a discovery by a great scientist, say 100 years ago, and that has been neglected or has not been properly developed, and you then understand it, and then you apply it to improve the condition of life, you have changed previous history as well as the present, just as you will intend to change the future. Look, we're all going to die. So what do you live for? Do you live like an animal to go out with a whimper? Or do you live like a human being knowing that you are doing something, you are developing in yourself, something which will be transmitted to future generations to make humanity better in the future? You no longer are a little person living in a little neighborhood with a little mind, with little ambitions and little interests. You suddenly become a very big person because you have the minds of some of the greatest people in history before you live in you, in your replication of what exactly their act of discovery. You do things with pride to say, he was right. This was a great discovery. We've got to use it for mankind's benefit. You say, I've got to do something to make the future better for those who come after us. And I can die with a smile on my face because I've lived well. I've lived at peace with the greatest people of the past, or at least some of them. And I can live at peace with joy in the people of the future. I will live forever in this process. That's what it is to be human. And when you think like that, and look at other people like that, you don't have a problem. You may have problems, but that's fun. Because if problems force you to attack and solve problems, whether as an individual or in conflict with others, that is fun. It's what the puppy does when the happy puppy is playing. The worst thing you can do to a puppy is not play with it. Make it angry. It gets bored. The worst thing you can do to a horse is not play with it, not work with it. It gets bored. It's unhappy. It may get sick and die on you. It has no purpose in life. Human beings have a different kind of play. It's that kind of play called cognition in respect to past and present, which makes an absolute moral difference, which defines the individual person as a creature made in the image of the Creator. When you think in those terms, then you think accordingly. Now, how do we get out of this mess? I've defined implicitly what the problem is. The problem is we are gripped by a system, a doomed system, a self-doomed system. This system, this financial monetary system, with its legal trappings such as Scalia, with its popular trappings such as popular opinion, this system, with its lack of sense of what humanity is, a lack of moral principle. There is no moral principle. If you don't have a sense of what humanity is, as I've described it, you have no morality. It's all mechanical. There's no morality in it. Morality involves passion. And passion, moral passion, is love for human beings. It's love for those who created people who went before you. It's love for those who are coming after you. To do nothing shameful in the eyes of those who came before you, even if you disagree with them. And to do nothing which is not beneficial to the society that comes afterward. No, in Plato called this agape. The Apostle Paul referred to this repeatedly, as in 1 Corinthians 13, as agape. Don't get involved like crazy Pat Robertson or Jerry Fall with these do's and don'ts, single issues. Forget the single issues. Don't marry about a list of do's and don'ts. Paul says the same thing. This is fraud. Concentrate on agape, which is the essence of all morality. And when you have agape, you don't need any other code except good judgment. Agape essentially is knowing what a human being is, knowing what humanity is, knowing what cognition is, and loving what you have received as benefits from the past, cognitively, and loving the future by giving to the future that which the future as human needs. And if you always act according to that, you may fall short in your understanding of what you need to do, but your intentions are always clear and moral. And that's what we lack essentially. That's the problem I face. I live in a society in which my generation was degenerate, became my degeneration. And my degeneration taught their children to degenerate still further. And now the thing is collapsing. And people are saying, "How? You got to fix the system. You can't change the system. You got to fix it. Don't talk about changing the system. Why don't you come up with some suggestion that will make the system work?" It's like, you know, find a way to make strychnine enjoyable. That's the problem. What comes down to, we have a shortage of leaders. And this problem of leadership has two aspects to it. One aspect is people who are qualified to be leaders. What's a person qualified to be a leader? A person who is essentially, for what I've said here, the person of agape. A person who has passion, who has love for humanity, who wants to do good for future humanity, to honor the noble contributions of people from the past, and to give something better to the future. Those people are leaders. people who will not sell out the principle of agape for the sake of opinion or personal advantage. Will be not self-sacrifice. What they have done in the United States in particular, what has been done to the American people, and I've only indicated the surface of this, the highlights of that over the recent period. When I came out of service at the end of the war, just after, while Roosevelt's life was still in memory, living memory of many of us who served abroad, we shared the opinion, most of us, even some boys from the South, we shared the opinion that, as I would express it more articulately than most of them would at that time, but they shared it, that we had just come through a Second World War, which we were about to win. That was sure at that point. And the question was, those of us who have served in Asia and saw the conditions of life in Asia, the oppression under colonialism of people in Asia, said you cannot expect to go through two world wars and fight them with what these have meant and ignore the great injustice to the great masses of Asia and not expect to have a third world war come haunt you sometime soon down the pike. We shared that view. We said, as Americans, it is our job. I didn't know what Roosevelt's policies were at the time. I had a smell of them. But these were my policies, and policies that I think most of the people who were in service with me at the time shared. We have to ensure that this ends, that colonialism and all its trappings ends. We have the power. We will come out of this war as the victors. We will have power in our hands. We can tell the world this system of colonialism is finished. And these nations, these new nations, are going to have the right, and with our assistance, to develop in the way we would want to develop. The way they choose, but with the same right. Within about 18 months of that time, probably 95% of the people I knew in service who had shared that view with me were on the other side. A gift of Trumanism. These were the people of my generation, the returning World War II veterans. Most of them sold out and were totally corrupt. I saw it. It stunk. I hated it. I saw my friends being self-destroyed. To see one destroyed is bad, but to see a person self-destroyed is the most horrible thing. These people became opportunists. They told their children, especially those in suburbia, be careful. Be careful. The neighbors are watching. And the children became shallow-minded hypocrites who would get, on the one hand, from education, those who had better education, would get a sense of certain values were good and certain were bad. Certain things were fair, certain things were unfair. These kinds of positive values would occur. But they were very shallow. They didn't have a deep sense of morality. They didn't have a sense of putting your life on the line if necessary for a principle. You don't put your life on your line because you want to die. You put your life on the line because it's so important to you to defend and uphold a principle that you will not hesitate to risk your life to defend that principle. And that's what these little kiddos didn't get. And when they got hit, as others did, with the 1962 missile crisis, and then with the assassination of John Kennedy, most of the generation, of the children of my generation, went crazy. It was called the rock, drug, sex counterculture. You know what happened, the 68er phenomenon. As it occurred in the United States, as it occurred in Europe. These things happened. And I found myself more and more, as we got into the 60s, middle 60s, standing alone. There was nobody there to lead, not really lead. People called themselves leaders, but they were all fake. And I found myself standing alone. I just said, I got to do something. I must do something. So I did it. And some people in the room know or had some experience with what I did. Now, I was right. The first thing, I was a good economist then, a very good one, probably the best, at least on performance. You look at the past, look at what I forecast, what I taught. I was better than anybody I know today alive from that period or even today. I was the best. So I took my skills and knowledge, and I just intervened on campuses and began impromptu educating young people wherever I could find them. And out of that came a movement. I did some more forecasting, and I was right. I have never made a forecast which did not turn out exactly as I specified it. Never. I've been in forecasting actually for more than 40 years. I never made a mistake in that. Well, I was also careful. I didn't forecast it. I wasn't sure. Someone says, give me a prediction. I say, no. I'll give you the ones I have. I don't make these things up, you know, on demand. I'm not like a slot machine. You put a quarter in and get a freaking forecast out. 71, the collapse. What happened in the late 60s? A series of monetary crises leading to a breakdown of the Bretton Woods system as it now existed, unless a certain change were made. It happened exactly that way. 1967, the British pound sterling crisis. February, March 1968, the dollar crisis. 1970, the Penn Central and Chrysler crisis. 1971, the collapse of the entire monetary system. 1975, a new wave of this. Then came the Carter administration, which destroyed all regulation to speak of, destroyed everything, infrastructure upon which this country was based. And we're suffering today because of a collapse of infrastructure which had been in progress for 30 years. For 30 years, the United States has had a negative investment in basic economic infrastructure, in transportation, in urban development, in power generation and distribution, in medical care, and so forth. We have been destroying ourselves as a nation over 30 years, culturally in every other way. And I found myself standing alone. I warned against Carter in a campaign I ran in 1976, and I was right. I warned against what Carter represented and what Bush represented in 1979, 1980, in that campaign. I was right. I warned what was coming out of the degeneration of the Reagan administration in 1984 in the presidential election campaign, which changed history in this country and in the world. And I was right. 1988, I forecast the immediately following collapse of the Soviet system and outlined what had to be done about that. And I was right. But I found myself, as you know, largely standing alone, surrounded by a few friends and a few friendly souls who would agree with me. It's a terrible responsibility to stand as I do at my age and to have these responsibilities. Because if I were to be taken, I don't know what would happen to the rest of you. I'm not talking just about the United States, I'm talking about the world. Because in this United States, I know the institutions of the United States, at least enough, well enough to know what the story is. There isn't the whole pack of political party leaderships, there is not the essential ingredient to save this nation. We have to inject it. And I, above all, have to inject it, which is why I'm running again. I have many people in Western Europe that I admire. They're not the large percentage of Western Europe, but they're a substantial number. in Germany, in Italy, a few in France, in Poland, in Hungary, in Czechia, Slovakia, the Balkans, so forth. They're good people. But they are not in a situation with the kind of leadership and knowledge necessary to put this back together again. Many of them are indispensable people in the sense that they represent an indispensable part of any combination which would put this thing into shape. But without my participation, they wouldn't make it. We have Asia, very good countries, very good people. But the Asian mind is not yet capable of dealing with a worldwide policy question. They deal rather with their relationship to the world in which they are embedded. And they're not stupid on that question. But they don't think in the right way to provide leadership for the world, to get out of this worldwide mess. South and Central America, well, it's another same process all over again. Leadership is essentially destroyed. The leadership that existed 20 years ago is no longer there. It's gone. Just a few aging people who remember. And that's the situation. Like one of the key leaders of Argentina is a man sitting in military prison. Can't find anybody else to lead. That's the situation. And therefore, it comes to the point, as now, that sometimes upon us falls the responsibility of leadership. It happens to all of us in some way or another, or many of us. Every physician will face that, because every sick person is a different person with a different disease, no matter what the diagnosis is. And the physician has to face the responsibility of dealing with that problem. A great teacher teaching a class of students faces the same thing about saving these young minds, a responsibility for saving them. Under these conditions today, it's a great, awesome responsibility. For some of us, the responsibility of the same singular variety comes in the same, in a different way, each in a different way. But to all of us, one thing is in common. When destiny has given you a vocation, and you have a mission, especially when you're the only one to play a key part in realizing that mission, you better accept it and do it. Thank you.
During an extensive question and answer period that took place following Mr. LaRouche's keynote address and continued on the following day during a lengthy afternoon session of the Schiller Institute ICLC conference, Mr. LaRouche was asked about the crisis in the Balkans, and in an answer to a question from a prominent official in the American Macedonian community, LaRouche went into a discussion about not only the Balkan War crisis, but also the international irregular warfare threat that he warned was coming to the United States. He talked about the looming demonstrations outside the IMF and World Bank meeting at the end of September, several weeks from now. But he also warned that what the United States was facing was something far more ominous, something far more serious than the kinds of street Jacobinism that we saw in Genoa in July at the G8 meeting. LaRouche warned in a very prescient and, in fact, eerie way that the United States was about to experience one of the greatest shocks in our nation's history. He did not say that on the basis of some kind of insider's foreknowledge about the plans underway for the attacks against the World Trade Center towers and against the Pentagon. He said that on the basis of a top-down understanding of the perilous strategic situation, of the danger of the global financial crash, and of the knowledge that there are those people within the extreme wings of the establishment in the West, in the United States, in Europe, and elsewhere, who are active, aggressive, irrational proponents of the idea of a clash of civilization. There are some people, typified by Zbigniew Brzezinski, by Samuel Huntington, who believe that it is in the best interest of the United States to see the Middle East explode into a religious war that would spill over across the planet and engulf every nation in a conflict of the sort that we haven't seen in this world for centuries. And it was on the basis of concern that those people were running loose and that the Bush administration may be ill-prepared to combat it and may, in fact, be infiltrated by people who share those views with the Brzezinskis and Huntingtons of the world, that he issued this warning about the strategic danger of an irregular warfare destabilization provocation against the United States. Precisely what LaRouche warned about occurred on September 11th, just 48 hours ago. We're still reeling from those events, but the only solution is to eradicate those elements from the policymaking establishment in this country, in Europe, and in other parts of the world who wish to play with billions of human lives and wish to plunge the world into a new dark age. This is an issue that we will be dealing with repeatedly over the coming weeks, so stay tuned to the LaRouche Connection. This is Jeff Steinberg.
You've been listening to EII Talks. To replay this program or to read the transcript, visit our website at larouchepub.com. That's www.larouchepub.com. EII Talks will return in a moment with closing announcements.